Hello and welcome to the CRV Podcast. I'm Jeff Wright, one of the regular contributors to the CRV website. On this episode, Chris Bolt speaks with Stephen Wolf about Christian political discourse and debate in 2020. Stephen graduated from West Point with a degree in philosophy and holds a PhD in political theory from Louisiana State University. He recently launched the Ars Politica podcast with Thomas Accord, and if you aren't already subscribed to that podcast, you should subscribe right away. We'll put links to Stephen's social media and the Ars Politica podcast in the show notes. All right, let's get going on Chris Bolt's conversation with Stephen Wolf.
This is Chris Bolt with the Conservative Resurgence Voices podcast, filling in again for Jeff Wright. This is our special election episode. As you are listening to this, we are getting ready to have the official election day in the United States of America for the President of the United States, and of course, all the other things that we're going to be voting on as well. You ask, why would we be talking about elections or politics and this sort of thing? Well, like it or not, this topic continues to come up in the Southern Baptist Convention. Some people have really reduced a lot of the various issues and the ways that people approach them to the political realm and to the candidate that one supports or the way that we think through politics. And so in one sense, we want to think of ourselves as transcendent politics in some way. We are Christians and that's what really matters. And then on the other hand, we really need a more fully developed political theology, a way to look at this issue. So I've brought on a guest that is a little bit different than others that you may hear or that you may read on the internet. There are just a plethora of articles out there talking about various pastors and whatnot and their views on the upcoming election or on political philosophy in general. But the guest we have today actually has studied this area. And I've brought him on because when I read his material, it always comes across to me as direct, first of all. It's not performative. It's very direct. It's also very articulate and clear. And this writer has challenged me on a number of different ways of thinking. And so I am glad to have him on today. And his name is Stephen Wolf.
Hi, well, thank you for having me on, Chris.
Thank you for coming on. Before we jump in here, I just want to mention, too, that John Piper recently penned an article on voting as well. And it was just shared widely all over the place. And so we're probably going to talk about that a little bit as well. But we don't want to date the episode too much. Nevertheless, those are some of the things that are going on as we are recording this episode for your listening pleasure. So thank you for joining CR Voices Podcast. Thank you, Stephen Wolf, for coming on. Stephen, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Doing great. Looking forward to the election season being over.
Well, that's good. That's good to hear from somebody who's actually into politics that you too are looking forward to it being over. So because I know that I am. Well, I brought you on to talk about something that I don't know a whole lot about, admittedly. And it's a topic that gets people's blood pressure rising, I know, when they talk about it. For those of you listening who think that a dispassionate analysis of political thought is a bad thing, this may not be the podcast episode for you because I'm a philosopher by training. And poor Stephen is also trained in this area of political thought. And so that brings us to the first question here, which is this. What is political theology and how does your recent work relate?
All right. Well, so I am not a political theologian. So I'll just say that up front. I'd call myself a reformed political theorist. And the reason I say that is probably would be controversial. I think political theology is, I'm sure that political theologians would disagree with this. But I see political theology as a discipline that's trying to relate heavenly life and earthly life. So how those two, you could say realms or kingdoms, relate to one another. And there's going to be different answers to how they relate. So you'd have two kingdom theology and others. I think for me, I take to be a classical Protestant view of these things, which I think is two kingdoms. I'm sure we can talk about that a little later. And in terms of recent work, I just finished dissertation a few months ago and defended it. I try to show how early New England Puritan political theology kind of had within it this basically the founding, the American founding in the late 18th century is in part kind of this expansion of and through experience is kind of a product of Protestantism, classical Protestantism. So that's what I try to argue in 300 pages. So that's kind of how it relates. I really think political theology, or how you understand the relationship between church and state and all that, really mattered in early American politics.
As somebody who's actually studied in these areas, how should we think about pastors and theologians developing their political philosophy versus outsourcing to actual political theorists? And what I mean by that is, we read article after article where usually pastors, usually celebrity pastors, kind of put their opinions out there on the internet. And I read these, and just about every one of them reads in a very similar way. They're usually something to the effect of, we can make room for moral goods on both sides of these issues, or on both of these major parties, or both of these candidates, or whatever. There's usually sort of this both and approach to virtually every one of these articles and whatnot that you read, or they're just scathing critiques of the moral character of some politician. It strikes me, though, that these are usually just celebrity pastors expressing their opinion on the internet, and it's in an area that they have not really studied. What are your thoughts on that, as far as how the church should approach these issues of politics and political philosophy?
Yeah, so I take my view is what I take to be kind of an early modern view. You see it with names that were well known in the 17th century and now not as well known. They would basically have a distinction between the political theorist and the theologian, the ethicist. They'd call, you know, sometimes the jurist. You'd have these distinctions in disciplines. That's not to say that someone who's trained as a theologian can't also do legal theory or can't do political theory, but just as disciplines, as topics, they were usually distinguished. And I think that's important, especially today, where the lines between theologian and political theorist and ethicist have kind of been blurred. And so now you have a lot of theologians, and political theology, I think, has expanded to include more than what it used to be. I think moral theology might have done that as well. So I think there is that there should be that distinction between what is the discipline of theology and the discipline of political philosophy. One's a sort of a practical philosophy. And the others, well, I guess theologians can debate on whether theology is practical, theoretical, or both. But I do think there's a difference, and I think that relates. I think on when it comes to actually pastors, but my view is that pastors should generally not preach on politics, and I say that not so much from a theology, philosophy, or theology, political theory concern, though I think that plays a part of it, but also just the fact that a pastor has a certain authority. Especially so when preaching, the idea that it's a spiritual event, there's a presumptive authority. And I think your posture as someone in the pew should be towards agreeing receiving the preached word. Of course, you want to be critical. But I think that your posture should be the preaching of the word of God is the word of God. That should be your posture. But if you're going to preach political ideas or political, you can say policy conclusions from the pulpit, you have to be very careful that you're not kind of abusing your authority. I know that's probably not popular on both the left and, I guess you could say, right. Here I am taking the middle position, but I just think that you don't want to abuse that authority as a pastor. So you got to be very careful. That's not to say that a pastor in the capacity of as citizen or as, you know, fellow subject can't have a view and can't express that view. But I think it shouldn't be through the office of pastor. It should just be as fellow citizens with an idea on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. I think in part pastors, I think they're trained to relate to people in ways that someone who analyzes policy, someone who thinks through politics as, you know, in the real world, pastors are not so much they're trained to administer the word and sacraments. And so I think their perspective can, to my mind, be kind of over egalitarian. It can usually be kind of soft in the sense that they don't understand trade-offs. They understand sometimes politics requires coercion, or sometimes it requires force. Sometimes it requires doing things that you don't want to do that are actually bad at some sense, but for the greater good. And that's basic trade-off. So I think sometimes pastors don't really get that, and they're not trained to do that. And so I think they should generally stay away. But there is that perspective that pastors are, you know, they have to preach the full counsel of God. That means everything, all of life. And they're supposed to be experts on everything. And I think that should be given to someone else. In terms of, you said outsourcing.
That's basically what you just mentioned at the end there. Yeah, as far as it being given to someone else.
Well, I think we should view the ecclesiastical institution as what it principally does is it orients people to heavenly life, you know, the life to come, eternal life, and it administers the word and sacraments and points people to Christ who's in heaven. And that's the principal role of the church as an institution. And pastors basically take the lead in that institution. But then you have civil institutions as well, and their primary role is to secure earthly goods for the flourishing of earthly life, and that is subordinate to heavenly pursuits because it's easier to contemplate or to worship God when you're not dealing with civil strife and there's no threat of war, there's no people being whatever it is that there's security and peace, and so the earthly is subordinate to the heavenly, but that doesn't mean that the church somehow dictates earthly politics. That the earthly realm is actually, or the you could say civil realm is where we discuss politics. And I think Christians, as Christians, should enter the civil realm, and not by the authority of their pastor, not by the leadership necessarily of their pastor, but just upon their own initiative within civil institutions to secure the best life possible. Given the circumstances. I think in that sense, the political theorist or the political actor or the policy person, that's their realm. So I guess I'm just outright rejecting the political church idea that's become fashionable. Yeah, but I'll just leave it at that.
The text in 1 Timothy 2. First of all, then I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made for all people, for kings and for all who are in high positions, that we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way. This is good, and it's pleasing in the sight of God, our Savior, who desires all people to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. And that just brought that passage to mind when you mentioned that a moment ago. Is that fair, of what you just said a moment ago about kind of the end game then for how we should think about politics?
Yeah, I think now a lot goes into what is peace and what's the best peace, what's the ideal, what's the, you know, ideal regime versus the best possible or the good enough. So, but yeah, I think that the ultimate object is, would be peace within kind of having civil order, civil justice, so that people can worship God in peace without distraction or disruption. I think that's, you could say the penultimate end, that is peace within civil realm. But I do think that when you discuss more of what peace entails, I think it can be a lot more robust than someone like Van Drunen would just have this basic common humanity piece. I think there's more to it than that, but yeah, I think that the penultimate is civil peace, and that's in the interest of the worship of God, which would be the ultimate end of civil order, is the unmolested worship of God, which is the principle, and which is principally by means of and in the church or church's institution.
Absolutely. Yeah, I ask that, you know, at 30,000 feet, just because even when it comes to the penultimate aim, it seems to me that there are some Christians out there, or professing Christians anyway, calling even some of these principles into question about peace as a goal or an aim, even with rights. And I know that the issue of rights is a massive discussion. I understand that. But, you know, there's this idea out there that freedom and rights are somehow, there's this negative baggage associated with them, so that they are put at odds with love for neighbor or something to that effect. And by the way, for the sake of the listeners too, you're not a Baptist to my knowledge. You're certainly not a Southern Baptist, but Baptists have a lengthy history of defending, you know, a separation of church and state and religious freedom as well. When you go back to John Leland and the Baptists in early America and that sort of thing. So there's a lot that could be said there, I think, even at 30,000 feet. And what is our aim here when we're doing politics? But with that, what do you think that Jesus means when he said his kingdom is not of this world? Because you see this thrown around a lot. I think it's sort of tossed out there sometimes to kind of piously place ourselves above all of these worldly politics, right? You talked about trade-offs earlier and this sort of thing. Can you maybe comment on that and how you would view that?
Yeah, so I think this is a really, really important concept to kind of grasp. And this ties back to what we just said. So for I said that the goal of civil life, you could say, is peace in order to worship God. Now, that means that civil life, or you could say the civil government, must enact laws, and laws have the backing of some kind of sanction and force. And so there must be some kind of, if that's kind of the goal of civil government, then there must be, let's say, trade-offs. There must also be, there must be violence. Now, I that sounds bad. I mean, by violence, I just mean basic. There must be force. Sometimes you got to suppress the murderers, and you got to suppress civil strife, that kind of stuff. So there has to be force in order to maintain civil order. And if Christians are can participate and have an interest in this civil order, then they should care and want policies that support civil order. But there is a tendency, like you suggested, to think of the Christ's kingdom is not of this world. And so we should be kind of unconcerned about the way things go here and not actually be part of what's necessary for there to be civil order. Because there, like I said, there is a tendency to think this stuff that it might be necessary to keep things safe and peaceful. Christians shouldn't have a part in that. Well, then you're basically saying that, I mean, one, you're saying that God has not authorized government and Christian participation in government that would include some kind of coercive force, and also to advocate for policies that would ensure that there's civil order and peace and all that. And I think the idea that Christ's kingdom is not of this world is a two kingdom concept, meaning that there's kind of a spiritual kingdom where all that the elect belong. It's something that's more inward, and it's not yet revealed. It's something that we as Christians have a sort of sacred bond and sacred unity, and it's seen visibly in the institutional church, but also in worship. But it still it's a heavenly reality or a not yet sort of reality. It's not yet visible sort of thing. And so in that way, like Calvin will say that, therefore, when you talk about the spiritual and civil kingdoms, you have to think of them in radically different ways because they're radically different. You have to separate them because if you don't do that, if you start allowing heaven to kind of enter into earth or earth enter into heaven, you start having these things start breaking down. So it's civil life and civil law starts breaking down. Then you call into question. One fear was the Anabaptist kind of rejection of law. Now that you have this freedom in Christ, well, why am I subjected to these civil earthly laws? And so you have this separation of the two kingdoms, say, no, you're still an earthly being, and there's still requirements of civil life upon you. And those are based in, all those civil requirements are based in the nature of man. And so grace, the grace of the gospel, does not eliminate, destroy, abrogate anything concerning this natural life. Just you could say restores it, or it reorients it to heaven, but it doesn't eliminate any of that. And so there's still the requirements of earthly life. And oh, by the way, there's sin. And so sin requires a kind of an augmentation of government or creation of civil government in order to deal with that reality of sin. And so just going back to what I originally said earlier, that now Christians have to participate in this augmented government or this civil life that has to suppress sin. So I think where your question was kind of going with is, well, Should Christians just step back from these requirements of civil life because they're kind of messy? I think there's always been a tendency within Christianity to do that, to think that way, to think that's the godly way to do it. And you see an Anabaptist and quasi-Anabaptist today doing that sort of thing. And I understand the argument, but I would just say that classical Protestantism says that you're in your civil life and you participate in the civil life and you ought to support it. And I think there's good reasons to affirm that position as well.
So let's get messy then. Here we are just prior to one of the most contentious elections that I know of, certainly in my life. This is probably the most contentious presidential election that I've ever seen, even more so perhaps than 2016. The two candidates for the two major parties in the United States of America are Donald Trump, who is already president, and then Joe Biden, who's challenging him. Of course, you've got Vice President Pence running with Trump, and then Kamala Harris. And so there's been a lot going on and a lot leading up to this election, from a global pandemic to protests to riots to all sorts of noise within evangelicalism, as well as in the Southern Baptist Convention. This is, of course, a Southern Baptist facing podcast. And so this is creating some difficulties even within our own denomination. I think most people are concerned that we not be known for sticking with one particular candidate or party, as though we're beholden to that candidate or that party, whereas others are saying, that's nice, but look at the other side and look at how terrible it is, and so on and so forth. And so lots of issues get thrown around. Of course, the issue of racism gets thrown out there. The issue of abortion gets thrown out there, and those are kind of played off one another. And then there's all of this, I guess it's called mudslinging, right, between these two main candidates. And so I just want to dip into this topic here. We can feel free to move around as we want. And eventually I want to get to your article, but I want to kind of hold off on that and just kind of go into the topic like this. What do you think about morality, character in candidates, and even this evangelical concept of public witness in relation to politics? And we can talk about John Piper's article as well. Let me just throw that out there. There was an article that John Piper penned years ago. Actually, he wrote one about single issue voting. And his argument was essentially that we need not necessarily be single issue voters, as though we're voting positively on one particular issue. But he said, in his own thought, that there are some things that are so just morally reprehensible or politically disastrous that he could not vote for someone who held to that or was pushing that. Abortion, of course, is what he was talking about. He was basically saying, look, you know, even if someone believes that that abortion is okay or whatever, that killing a child in the child's mother, if somebody believes that's moral or okay or whatever, then that person is essentially disqualified from politics. Well, he came out on October 22nd with an article saying that there are actually other sins that we should consider as well. And he actually says in this article, the title of it is Policies, Persons, and Paths to Ruin. And in this article, he says, I remain baffled that so many Christians consider the sins of unrepentant sexual immorality, unrepentant boastfulness, unrepentant vulgarity, unrepentant factiousness, and the like, to be only toxic for our nation, while policies that endorse baby killing, sex switching, freedom limiting, and socialistic overreach are viewed as deadly. And I thought to myself when I read that, well, Dr. Piper, you wrote an article several years ago that was encouraging that type of thought, to where we do view this one as deadly and others as perhaps merely toxic. So I've given you just a full plate of spaghetti there, and you know how spaghetti is. It grows and grows on your plate. You attack this however you want to, and we're going to sit back and listen to you. Again, what do you think about morality, character, the evangelical concept of public witness in relation to politics? What do you think about Piper's argument and article there?
Oh, yeah, that's a lot. Well, let me first acknowledge that if you look at the Christian tradition on the virtue of civil rulers, it's undeniable that that they're called to be virtuous, and it's undeniable that in the past someone like Trump probably would not be considered virtuous. So that needs to be acknowledged up front. And of course, I'm going to say, when that tradition was developed, and that, you know, of course that goes way back, when that was acknowledged and developed, that was in a time where there was not, you can say, modern constitutionalism. It was a time when the prince was sometimes considered the civil ruler was considered the embodiment of the law. He could change law, he could abrogate law, he could not follow it himself, depending on who you're talking to. So there wasn't this modern constitution. So what do I mean? Well, in our system of government, we have checks and balances. Everyone's heard that before, and so the bad character of a civil ruler can be checked by the other institutions, or the other branches of government. And I think you've seen, I mean, if Trump is a some sort of dictator, kind of latent dictator, then he really has proven not to be a very effective dictator, despite what some of the hysterical, Trump derangement syndrome people might say. So anyway, I think I understand. So Piper's saying that all those can be deadly to a nation. And while that is true, I think one recent experience has shown that's not true. I think part of the reaction to Trump has not so much been Trump, but actually it's been the response to Trump that's been more the problem than Trump himself. I mean, Trump has his own problems, but the fact that the entire ruling class, from media, academia, evangelical, everyone has gone after Trump, I think shows that they were the ones who were destabilizing. They were the darkness for democracy. But I don't want to go through all that again. But I think that's important to think through Trump in the context of modern constitutionalism restraining bad behavior. And so I think that then you can approach a candidate. This kind of goes into voting. We can get that in a moment. But you approach a candidate thinking, well, how is this guy? We don't like all these character features of him. Some we like, some we don't, but we do like a lot of his policies. And so I think you can view his bad character as a unfortunate byproduct of the sort of personality that actually gets the policies you want. So that is my, I guess you could say, defense, of voting for Trump, though I have, we can talk about that theory a little more, but I think, in considering character, it matters. It's a factor, but it doesn't have to be the governing principle, over who you vote for. The second one is public witness. All right. So we've heard the public witness for almost 5 years now, this public witness, moral witness, Christian witness talk. It's the same argument over and over and over and over. We've seen it for years. The problem with this idea of public witness, the way it's used, is who's the witness? Who's the audience? Who are you witnessing to? Because if almost half the country, at least those who voted for Trump, then are you witnessing to those people through your public witness by repudiating Trump, or repudiating the guy that most people vote for? Are you witnessing to them? I think in the end, you discover that public witness really is about, if the audience are the cultural leaders, or you could say the coastal elite, the audience is the ruling class, and it's to show that you, my theory is that what's contained in the term public witness is your subtle is signaling to the ruling class, as evangelicals, that you are not a threat to their rule. I think that's what public witness comes down to. And the way that's enforced is that we'll condemn abortion and some other stuff. But generally speaking, our entire program is really not a significant real, it's not a real threat to actual the ruling class. And you see this, the theology that's developed over the five years by a lot of guys within the evangelical elite. The whole thing is designed to basically weaken Christians on the political stage. It's the idea that almost goes back to the previous questions, is that Christ's kingdom is not of this world. And so we disengage in a certain sense, or we engage in a certain way, in order to, have this great, quote, public moral witness, which in the end signals to the ruling class that, in the end, we are not actually a threat to you. So I think that's what public witness is really about. And it's enforced on us with this new theology. I think it's new. It's quasi-Anabaptist. It's not classical Protestant. It's not 1689 Baptist. It's not Presbyterian. It's this new kind of modern invention that I think weakens, it nullifies evangelicals as a threat to the ruling class. But the whole idea of public witness, if the ruling elite are kind of the audience of this witness, the way that they enforce it themselves is that they're the bafflers. They're the ones who are baffled. Even John Piper in this essay as well mentions that even non-believers are baffled by our willingness to throw a hat in with someone like Trump. And so we kind of allow the ruling class, or at least our perception of them, and their posturing in relation to our political actions, we allow them to have this shaming. We impute toward them altruism as if they're not using this as a means of power. They're not doing that. They're actually sincerely, they're sincerely baffled. They sincerely care about the fact that we are hypocritical. Like that's the idea. Whereas I'm basically saying that these guys don't care for hypocritical because they themselves are hypocritical. I've seen that repeatedly over the last month, especially during the COVID crisis, how hypocritical the ruling class can be on that front. But yeah, they don't care if we're hypocritical. They only care that we are quote hypocritical or that we don't meet our moral standards because it's a means of attacking us. It's a means of really depressing us, dispiriting us. It's a means of making us weak and self-reflective to the point of inaction, or at least inaction that they like, but inaction on the things that would be more in our interest. So that's what, I mean, that's a long, so I think there's a lot to those few words, public witness, and it drives me nuts to see it. And I think there's a reason why, I've said a lot on this, but there's a reason why they use that term public witness and never actually analytically analyze what it is. They never analytically describe it. They never make distinctions. They never say who the object, the end, the principle behind it. They never talk about it. They just throw it out there as public witness. It's a means, I think, of there's a reason why they do that. And that is, one, I think a lot of these guys don't even really know what they're saying. They haven't really thought it through. I think there's a few people in the evangelical elite crowd who I think are really smart and they know what they're up to. I'm not going to name names on that, but there's an army, I think, of kind of underlings who just kind of repeat these things. They spout them off. Even people who write a lot, the people who write a lot of essays on these various sites or have their own sites, I think they're really just spouting off these lines. They have a set of like 25 lines, maybe 30, maybe 40, if they're better, they're good. And they don't really, there's not a whole lot of meaning there or intellectual content. It just works. Because their audience is socialized into these ways of framing things and these phrases that it works and they get clicks and likes and they think they're being intellectual. But really a lot of this stuff is just entirely vacuous. I think like public witness or moral witness or Christian witness, just there could be something meaningful. There's potential to have a meaningful, that be a meaningful term and actually useful term. But the way it's used is just it's basically devoid of meaning, but people are so socialized into a certain reaction to these things. You see public, oh, our public witness, or you're accused of hypocrisy. Oh, I'm a hypocrite. We're all hypocrites. You see this over and over and over and over, and there's not a whole lot of critical thought into what any of this means, but people react to it in these programmed ways. And again, I think public witness is one of those things. And I think if we read a lot of these evangelical elite guys' articles, if you read them as assuming that it's not, if you read it and you realize that they didn't really say anything meaningfully, there wasn't a logical structure, there wasn't demonstration, you know, like premise, conclusion. If there was nothing like that in the article, then you can treat that article not as something that you engage intellectually. You treat it as something to reveal its rhetorical tricks. You relate to it with suspicion. You don't deny its conclusions because its conclusions aren't supported and it's vacuous in meaning. So anyway, I'm kind of getting off topic from public witness, but I think that's really kind of vital when you're approaching these guys' articles and these terms you see floating around is that don't deny anything. Don't affirm anything. just say it's a bunch of nonsense and critique it along the lines as like this sort of programmed rhetoric or rhetoric that engenders like these programmed responses. Yeah. I'll keep going. I'll keep going. So I'll stop there.
Well, I think that's really helpful. I think that perhaps it's helpful to think about it as analogous to theology. And so you have what I would call a bumper sticker theology out there, right? So, of course, Jesus saves. This is true, right? But you see Jesus saves on a bumper sticker or something. And that's not the whole story, right? That's not the whole of the gospel.
Or Jesus doesn't wave an American flag. It's like, oh, Okay.
Right. So that's the political analog. Yeah. Or you have, there is some bumper sticker theology that's truly awful as well, right? So try Jesus. Well, that's really, really bad theology. And even though you're only stating two words there on your bumper sticker on your car or whatever, you've actually managed to still mess it up. And so I think that perhaps this is similar to what you're saying with regard to a lot of so-called political philosophy. It's really not political philosophy that we are constantly imbibing, usually from, again, as I see it, evangelicals who have no training in this area. And so I think that's actually really helpful, as hard hitting as some of that may be to some people.
Yeah, a lot of these guys have not really taken a political theology or politics course. And even if they have, I don't think that they may not even matter at all. But they've been socialized into this sort of program. It's not systematic. It's not analytical. It's a sort of, I want to say almost feel good, but that's too kind of surface level. I think it's something deeper than that. It's just this, it works. I think that these lines work. Sometimes you read these Gospel Coalition articles and you just shake your head. Like, there's gotta be an editor. The editors have to be smarter than this. Like, they have to read this and say, this is just not good. You know, they have to say, this is just send back, rewrite, or whatever their editorial processes. Yeah. So it's just, it's really, really bad. But I should say that a lot of what passes as political theology in evangelical circles, I would say isn't even political. And that's because it doesn't actually deal, it's not about politics. If it's about public morality or public witness or that sort of thing, and it isn't actually something that you can enact in real life in real politics, then it's not political, because the purpose of political action is for political end, meaning you want to change the law, you want to make things like civil life better, human flourishing, whatever your buzzword is. But if it's really just about showing off your great morality to some group out there, and it's not really about actually changing politics, and you know, and if you're not affirming the basic necessities of politics, which is you have to implement the law, it has to be enforced, it has to be sanctioned to it. If you don't believe any of that stuff, or that is meaningless to you, then it's not politics. So I think a lot of people, they've been trained in a quote political theology, but it's really not a political theology at all. It's like a sort of moral theology. I would say moralistic theology it passes for political theology just because it seems to be something you assert in the public square when it's not. It's not even political at all. I'd say just about everything that people like Russell Moore say is like that. other people in Gospel Coalition and related groups, again, it's a moral theology, moralistic theology. It isn't even political at all.
That's interesting. And I think that's a helpful distinction again. So you mentioned earlier the role of pastors in a lot of this. And so that's what I would take it upon myself to do, is to speak to the morality of an issue, right? I mean, there's the kind of the pious saying out there that the most political statement you can make is Jesus is Lord. So I'm certainly going to affirm that. Caesar's not Lord, right? Jesus is Lord. So I'm going to affirm that, no doubt. But at the same time, you're right. I mean, I'm not up there. And this is what I was talking about at the beginning of the podcast episode. I mean, I don't know all of the ins and outs and the philosophies behind these things and that sort of thing. And there are also lots of different things that people do in politics that don't make sense to someone outside of those decisions, right? I know enough from member meetings using Robert's Rules of Order to understand that, or being on the floor of the Southern Baptist Convention. There are politics in play in those scenarios as well. And sometimes people, they will do something that actually looks like they're trying to accomplish even the opposite of what they're actually trying to accomplish. So yeah, you're right. And I think that's really helpful, actually. It's not that the morality is bad, though, right? We can still comment on those things.
Well, what I was going to say, yeah. So it's not just that I think pastors often aren't trained in these things, because a lot of people aren't really trained in, like, I'm not trained in policy myself, but I have policy preferences. I do political philosophy. So, I think that the problem is that pastors often, when they preach from the pulpit, their mentality is, if they're going to say, do this, don't do that from the pulpit, they're not going to say, well, it depends on the trade-off. You know, they're not thinking in terms of how do you solve one problem and then avoid another problem, or how do you balance which problem is there, that's not happening from the pulpit normally. You know, it's more like an absolute, don't do this, don't do that. or do this, don't do that. But in policy and in politics, that's impossible. You have to think in terms of trade-offs. So, I mean, just as an example, police officers carry guns. Now, if we would say that police officers sometimes use their weapon in an unjust or accidental way that leads to suffering or harm or death, that obviously happens. And so that's a problem. How do we eliminate that problem? Well, let's just take all the guns from the police. Hey, we solved that problem. Now police are no longer shooting people unjustly or by accident, right? But then we solved the problem. But all that did, most likely, is exacerbate a whole other problem, which would be disrespect for cops. Maybe cops are getting killed or hurt themselves. The rule of law is suffering. Maybe more people are getting murdered because there's less law enforcement. And so, what do we do now? Well, let's give the cops guns again. And then a year later, we have some people who were killed unjustly or by accident by the cops. And so there's a trade-off there. In one sense, you want to solve a problem. Is there some evil involved, whether it's accidental or intentional or unjust? The cop hurting, killing people. But in the reality of this world as it is that you have to sometimes implement a policy that has a negative side effect that you just have to, you try to reduce the best you can, but it's going to happen. If you have thousands of cops out there each day and you have thousands of arrests, sometimes violent arrests, or violent offenders, there's going to be times where this sort of thing happens, just statistically. So that's the kind of thing, but pastors are not, they don't think in those terms because that they don't preach in those terms, and that's fine. It just, but the problem is then Christians start thinking that way as well. They see this is a problem, like the no-knock arrest thing with Breonna Taylor. Now there might be legitimate concern with the no-knock arrests or the way that the house was raided and how it was conducted and all that. I get all that. Maybe I'm an expert in that or exactly what happened there. But if we're going to remove one policy or tactic in policing, you have to ask, well, is the removal of that policy going to, what's the side effect of that? We're solving one problem. What is it exasperating? Anyway, I think that's just the idea of trade-offs. That sort of trade-off is something completely foreign to evangelical thinking. So, I mean, the same thing with the child separation policy on the border and all that. It's the same question. I don't want to get into specifics at all those, but it's the same issue. Well, if you don't do that, what's the downside? So, but yeah, of course, don't deny morality. It's just that because of the nature of our world, you have to weigh the consequences of the policy. The same thing with the war on so-called war on drugs. The big criticism is that, it throws a lot of people in prison for these kind of so-called no victim crimes, right? Well, if you don't throw them in prison, they're going to be dealing more drugs. So I don't know the answer to that. But the fact of the matter is that if you do one thing or the other, you're going to have this problem or that problem and you have to deal with it. The world is not so simple that there's a policy that solves a problem and doesn't raise others. In fact, almost all of them do. So, I mean, and just the fact that you have limited resources, we don't have unlimited. It seems like it we do nowadays. But if we have limited resources and we look at society and says, that's a problem. And we just throw throw some resources on that. There's another problem. Well, if there's 1,000 problems, you only have enough, 100 units of problem solvers. You're only going to solve 100 problems out of 1,000. And so you have to decide, which problems are you going to allocate resources to solve? And so you can't do it all. But this thinking, this is what I think would be, I mean, it's a policy thinker, but it's also in politics as well. Yeah, it's also in politics as well, this idea of trade-offs. And Christians have completely lost it, I think, partly because they think their job is to bring heaven to earth or to be a heavenly ambassador or something like that. But you have to face the way the world is, be a participant in civil life.
Well, that leads us up nicely to the closing question here. But I want to note before we get into that, of course, we're going to be canceled now because you mentioned the necessity of violence earlier. The Bible talks about use of the sword. That's just what the state is.
The idea of Max Weber would say that the definition of the modern state is the entity that has the exclusive use of violence.
Yeah.
So there you go. I'm just reflecting basically.
No, I knew what you meant. I was just sitting here thinking, oh, good. The necessary use of force and violence. And we're talking about Donald Trump and all of these things. This should go over well. But no, everything that you just said, we were talking about all these articles. We're talking about evangelicalism and the way that by and large everything is approached through this sort of moral lens. And then we're talking about the differences, categorical differences between that and policy and trade-offs and thinking through these things. And we talked about how it's the messy part of politics, but in reality, it's not actually that messy, is it? It's just that it's a different set of tools. It's a different category altogether. So this leads me to this final question here. I'm going to ask you about what is a consequentialist view of voting? But I want to clarify, I don't think that you mean consequentialism here in the sense of some sort of utilitarian or consequentialist ethic. You wrote an article on December 14th, 2017 for Mere Orthodoxy. And the title of that article is A Consequentialist Theory of Voting. You go through this article and you use almost like a Socratic sort of approach where you'll say something like, you'll state a principle, voting for a candidate is an endorsement of a candidate's moral life as it pertains to civil righteousness. And then you question that. And you provide biblical pushback. And then what it leads you to do is to make a more specific principle. So you restate it all the way down until you have like this paragraph of qualifications. And then you knock that one down too. And so talk to us a little bit about what you were thinking in that article, what you might change now. And what does this have to do with the things we've been talking about?
Okay. Yeah, I'm glad you didn't read the principle because I'd probably change it now. But So in 2016, what we saw a lot in the evangelical world was this saying that if you vote for some guy, so if you vote for a candidate, you kind of endorse his sin. Basically, they were saying you vote for Trump, you're endorsing adultery, that kind of thing, which is interesting. Now, 4 years later, how that line is that no one actually makes that argument anymore, because now they're saying it's okay to vote for Democrats. Some people are saying that. So what I tried to do is say, wait, there's different types, or you say levels of sin. So we have like internal sins. We could do something that's great and everyone celebrates us and we get an award or whatever. But in the end, on the inside, we just did it because we were terrified or we were lucky or whatever. We didn't do it to the glory of God. And so it was sin. In the eyes of God, it was sin. Do we endorse that sin by voting for him? Well, I don't think so. What if these minor sins, what if we honked at someone driving and we were mad when we were driving or something like that? Do we endorse that sin? Well, no. And so I kind of go down like you said, I developed the principle, with these questions of, well, these different types of sins. Well, I don't think that we endorse this sin. And I basically say, okay, reader, deny that. But in the end, I say, well, it's consequential. In other words, we in the end, the only thing that makes sense is that we vote for a guy based upon what we think he's going to do in office, like the good he's going to do in office, which is what I say is I use the word consequentialism, which is kind of provocative, I admit. It was a kind of a provocative use of that word because that's the word everyone was accusing others of doing. So I said, I'm just fine. I'll take the word and just affirm it. So I said it's consequential. What I mean, though, is not so much like the ends justify the means. I don't mean that we can vote for a tyrant and a tyrant who has good policies. I don't mean that. I just simply mean that how do you justify your vote for someone or decide who to vote for? I say, well, it's the outcomes of that guy's, if that guy was elected. So you vote for Trump thinking he's going to have the best policies versus the other guy or whatever. So it's basically just outcome. I just argue that we already do this anyway. It's the only thing that makes actual sense. And so we have to kind of weigh the consequences, which means, okay, yeah, Trump has this sin history. He's unrepentant. You can do the list. And there's been so many articles, dozens of articles that do the list of everything he's done wrong in his life, which we can all affirm is wrong. Most of them, we could say that was wrong and evil and wouldn't want. So yeah, and we can condemn those individual actions. But if I vote for him, am I endorsing, say his adultery by voting for him? And my argument, my framework is saying, well, you only would if somehow that adultery leads to bad policies through his administration or something like that. And so I think that, and I guess you could make that argument. People are free to make that argument. I just don't think it's true, partly from what I said early on in the podcast, which was the idea of modern constitutionalism, where the excesses of someone is usually filtered out by means of checks and balances within the constitutional structure. So I think that if for this election, we have 4 years of Trump, And so I think that given the framework, I think you're free to vote for him. You're morally justified in voting for him based upon what you think are going to be the consequences of his presidency, if you think it's good or bad. So to my mind, the real issue is not whether voting endorses his sin, but whether what sort of consequences we're going to see and whether those are actually good consequences or bad consequences, or, you know, good or bad. And so that's the argument. I also lay out that there's factors involved so that I think we can all say that we want a leader who has good character and perfect and all that. And so, but we weight these different things. One thing would be, well, Trump has this thing where he doesn't care what the ruling class thinks. And part of the reason why he doesn't care what other people think, I mean, his theory is involved, but part of that, I think his other things that we don't like, we wish he didn't, wasn't like, I would say is can be a byproduct. You can treat it as kind of a byproduct of what you do like, which is he doesn't care what people think of him. Or at least I could say he does things that he doesn't mind offending the pieties of the secular pieties of the ruling class. And so if you're thinking, well, look, if we want our policies to go through because we think these policies are good, we're going to weight that higher than we are his other character, because in fact, part of that character is actually going to help him or allow him to implement these policies. So even though I'm disappointed in Trump in a lot of ways, I think at least you can approach it from that way. And so this isn't so much an argument for voting for Trump. I think my argument just lays out what I think is a coherent framework to talk about voting. And it just frankly admits, I think that I try to be very clear that, look, this is what we do anyway. And I've never really seen anyone, I think Jonathan Lehman kind of touched upon this, but I just wanted to be like very direct, like this is what we are doing. And I'm just going to say it outright, just right here explicitly. And then everyone kind of dances around it. And I mean, you know, So that's what I mean by consequential. I guess you could say outcome-based voting. That might be probably less provocative.
If you don't follow something like this and you do go down the rabbit hole of let's compare the morality of these candidates, well, I'm sorry, but I mean, what politician can you not dig up some sort of dirt on? And I don't mean to say that to mitigate some of the horrible things that any of these current candidates have done, but if you go down that route, then you're looking for a list of qualifications, moral qualifications that don't really even directly pertain to politics necessarily, or to these consequences, as we might call them, or outcomes, right? So I think this article kind of saves you from that and shows you there is a different way to go about this as a Christian who does care about morality. And by the way, I'm about to do the both sides thing. And the reason I'm about to do the both sides thing is because we've been talking about Trump a great deal. And the reason we've been talking about Trump, and I'm just going to say, if you listen to what Stephen said, because I'm not saying anything about it, but if you listen to what Stephen said, there are actual moral objections with regard to Trump. But on the other hand, we're talking about politics here. It's not as though there's not some sort of overlap or something to that effect. But this consequentialist theory of voting, this article, is just fantastic in helping us to think through this sort of thing, not just with respect to this very contentious election coming up. And by the way, again, the both sides thing, I'm not impressed by the moral uprightness of the left either. So, you know, there's that. But anyway,
the thing I'd like to say is about the factors or weighting things. I think one thing that's been striking about the last 4 years is it's one thing is Trump's kind of revealed a lot that I think was kind of below the surface or concealed. And one of those things is how much the evangelical leaders / elite, how much they care about manners, how much they care about these certain civil pieties and civility that Trump, the things that Trump lacks. And people might be thinking, well, what's wrong with that? Well, I think that they weight it so high on the list of requirements that it makes it so they fail to see how disastrous many of the policies were within the last 15 years since I think Bush was elected. So the wars, all this stuff was done with great civility, all these arguments. And then you think the fundamental transformation that started under Obama with the kind of sexual transformation since 2008 up until Trump, that was under the Obama years. And you know, Obama's like, he's Mr. Smooth and Mild. And so he's got a nice family and all these. And so you can praise him for all these things, great manners and all that. But at the same time, these two presidents, arguably, I'd say it all goes back to Lyndon Johnson. You have like these smooth politicians who have all the right manners and say all the right things, and yet have these disastrous policies. They're not responsive to the will of the electorate. And they do it under, like I said, the cover of these manners and poise and dignity. And so I think we shouldn't place so much weight on those, or at least we should put in perspective that oftentimes those things are just cover for something else. And I think that that evangelicals are so elite, are in some sense that they're the sons and daughters of the moral majority that placed this high value in public morality, despite the fact that they were losing disastrously in policy front and culturally. So I think that we should have a more critical approach to what civility actually did for us. The last few decades.
A good part of wisdom is understanding or having a sense of proportionality. I want to thank you again for coming on and talking to us about all these controversial things. Listeners, if you have any complaints or whatever, don't send them to me. Send them to Stephen. So is there anything else that you want to add before we close out?
I'm a Presbyterian. I'll just say that. I think you said earlier that you didn't know if I was a Baptist. You didn't think I was a Baptist. I'll just say I'm Presbyterian.
Yes, yes. So we won't. So for all the, we won't then, close then I guess this one with the baptize those, your babies thing, like other people.
No, I won't do that. All the Baptists can now dismiss everything I said because it came from a Presbyterian. But I know it's great. I'm so glad that I was able to talk about these things. I'm usually trying to say these things on Twitter, but now I can say it like this. Hopefully it made sense for everyone.
It definitely made sense. And again, I think it's very helpful. And again, I would encourage the listeners to go and check out some of the things that Stephen Wolfe has written. I think there are quite a few articles out there, actually, but we focused on the one from Mere Orthodoxy, Consequentialist Theory of Voting. Jeff will tell you about some of the other articles that we referenced in this episode, plus other places you can find Stephen, including his podcast. And I'm going to let him go right now because I think he has to go and record an episode for that. But thank you for listening to Conservative Resurgence Voices podcast. Again, this has been Chris Bolt filling in for Jeff Wright. And I hope you'll use wisdom in how you decide to vote this election season. And I hope that I don't have to talk about this topic again for at least another 4 years. Thank you for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
Thanks to Stephen Wolfe for taking time to come on the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to his podcast, Ars Politica, which you can find on all major podcast platforms. We will provide a link to the podcast in the show notes for this episode. Thank you for listening to this episode of the CRV Podcast. If you have enjoyed the show, we would appreciate you taking a moment to leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform, as well as telling a friend about the podcast. For all the folks at CRV, this is Jeff Wright, wishing you all the best in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. We'll be right back.